Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is now 1:03 PM, Monday, January 24th, 2022. Constituting a quorum, we have with us Representative McKay. Online is Representative Fields, Representative Kronk, Representative Hopkins, myself, Putkudup, Representative Rauscher, Representative Hannon, Representative Gillum, and Representative Schrage. Picking up where we left off on Friday, we'll be going over House Bill 135, which is the geothermal resources. I'd like to say thank you to our recording secretary Shannon and our LIO moderator Lydia. And joining us in the audience, we have Ms. Laura Bruberschein, and I believe Ryan, I don't know his last name, out of Representative Rauscher's office.
McKee.
We just met the other day, so I should be forgiven once on the last name, right, at least. Please silence your cell phone, set them up on a notepad so we don't get the vibration through the whole table. And we'll go ahead and pick up where we left off with House Bill 135. As you recall, last meeting we had some questions regarding clarifications of water rights and how this bill might affect those. And we received some follow-up information over the weekend from the departments clarifying that. And I guess before we do pass it off to Ms. Bruberschein, we'll just recognize the folks on Teams and online. We have Sean Clifton with the Division of Oil and Gas, Dave LePain with DGGS, Tom Barrett with DMLW, and Laura Ashe with DEC. I believe she's on the phone. So with that, go ahead, Ms. Bruberschein and Mr. Clifton.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that we're going to go right to slide 9 in the last presentation and discuss that. And I want to take this opportunity to clarify what was written on that slide. And to preface it, you know, this bill seeks to clean up the statutes pertaining to the Division of Oil and Gas relevant to disposing of the state of Alaska's geothermal energy resources for the purpose of issuing exploration licenses and leases and ultimately units of those leases, facilitating getting clean renewable energy into Alaskans' homes. And the mention of water rights was just meant to be an analogous comparison. And I take responsibility for writing that, and I apologize if that was confusing to the committee. And as far as I understand it, this has no impact on the statutes that are relevant to water rights. And we have Tom Barrett here on the line to help clarify how water rights would be potentially relevant to a geothermal development situation, as well as water rights generally. And he's our expert on this from Miami Land and Water, and I hope that he'll be able to clear up any questions that you may have lingering. If you would like to take that away, Mr. Barrett, please do.
Thank you very much. Happy to answer questions on water rights. And I thought I'd just start with a real high-level review. People can hear me okay through the chair.
Yeah, if you can speak up a little bit, we'll try to turn the volume up on our end. But
okay, I'll try to talk a little closer to the microphone if that helps. Okay, so water rights. A legal right to use surface or groundwater that's granted pursuant to the Alaska Water Use Act. And a water right allows a specific amount of water from a specific water source to be diverted, impounded, or withdrawn for a specific use. Now, when a water right is granted, it becomes pertinent to the land where the water is being used, or as long as the water is being used. And if the land is sold, the water right transfers with the land to the new owner. What else? So an example would be if you were a farmer and you had a creek running through your property, you would need a water right to authorize the use of a significant amount of water. Now, significant amount of water is something that's defined. It's about 5,000 gallons per day for consumptive use, or 30,000 gallons for non-consumptive use. And that's kind of getting more into the details here, but basically, you know, why you want to have a water right? So if you have a water right, you have a legal standing to assert those rights against conflicting water users who do not have water rights. And then Alaska is a state that's a prior appropriation state, meaning a person with a water right has priority to use water over persons who later file for a water right for the same source. So we've got about 18,000 or so water rights in Alaska that are issued. And, you know, when we go about issuing a water right, you know, we take an application from an applicant. We process it. We review it for completeness. It needs to have a specific location and a method of diverting the water, as well as, you know, a small fee. And we basically do an impact analysis. You know, we don't guarantee people's water. We don't really provide it that way. But we do look to be sure that it's not going to affect other appropriators. And if it looks like it's not going to affect other appropriators, we go forward and typically we'll issue a permit for a period of 2 to 10 years, depending on the amount of water requested. In this permit phase, the applicant uses their water and they report their water use to us. And at the end of the permit phase, this is what we call proving your water right. We issue a certificate for the amount of water that they actually use. And that's how we manage the water. So any questions on that or how that, you know, correlates to the geothermal bill?
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair. Mr. Barrett, some of our edification around this bill has the bright line distinction between commercial users and non-commercial users. So when you've been describing water rights, can you tell me, is there a distinction between commercial users? You had some volumes that would, to me, imply a commercial user, but do individual users who are non-commercial in Alaska have to establish a water right to, and I'm not thinking of the creek runoff, but to put a well in. And so as you gave us numbers, are those all commercial users with water rights that you were referencing that Division of Mining, Land and Water would be monitoring, taking fees from, and having to adjudicate amongst other commercial users, or are personal users who are putting in wells going to need to establish a water right?
Okay, thanks very much for the question, Mr. Chair. The water rights are really purely based on volume. So if you use less than 5,000 gallons of water from a single source in a day, or less than 500 gallons per day from a single source, more than 10 days. Basically, if you're a homeowner and you have a well, you don't have to get a water right. It's that volume that kind of triggers it, 5,000 gallons. Does that answer your question, through the chair?
Follow-up, Representative Hannah.
It largely answers my question, but I guess then to step it out, how does that individual who has a well, a smaller volume, but if a geothermal commercial property gets developed and they need water for their commercial use, how do we preserve the rights of the individual property owners well to make sure that they are going to be able to continue to have access to the water they've been using and have not had a water right established because they didn't need to?
Right, yeah. That is the benefit for having the water right, even if you're not required to, if you're a homeowner. That water right basically gives you the prior priority date. So I guess if this answers your question better, if you don't have a water right, and another entity comes up with a neighbor has a large commercial operation that uses a lot of water and can pass you. Well, for one, you're probably going to have to work with your neighbor and let them know that there's an impact. But firstly, when we do issue a water right, we do look for surrounding water users. But really, your best protection is to get a water right.
Additional follow-up, Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through the chair. So do you know, are there any individual non-commercial users in Alaska who currently have wells who've established water rights so that they've protected their use and access to that water in perpetuity? Or are only water permits currently larger operations and commercial users?
Yes. Thanks for the question, Representative Hannon, through the chair. And yes, there are a lot of what I call household or domestic water rights owners.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barrett. Thank you, Representative Hannon. Representative Rauscher.
thank you, through the chair. I have to get someone some clarification here. I'm following along where Representative has been trying to go here. I can remember way back, I've been here for 45 or more years now, where it was a big deal for everybody to establish their water rights way back when. And I don't, I'm trying to understand, was that a process that has ended? Is that a process that now all you have to do is drill a well in the ground and you have specific water rights now? And how does this piece of legislation affect, does it change those rights at all? Does it put any extra encumbrances on those rights at all, or does this legislation not affect those rights at all? And can you tell me the difference between those two that I had were trying to remember like 45 years ago and then just what a well does for you right now? Did that get too confusing for the question, or did you follow me on that?
Oh, thanks for the question, Representative Rauscher, from the chair. I think I can answer your question. So a well is basically just your access to the water. It's not your, it doesn't trigger the permit. So if you want a water right, you need to submit an application to a department. And in that application, you would describe, you know, how you're getting the water, whether you're diverting a stream or putting in a well or something like that.
Okay, and then the follow-up?
Representative Roach.
So then this legislation, does this matter to any of those people who are privately owned land, and does this legislation not bother or change one thing for those who have already gotten private water rights for their property or a well or anything like that?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, this does not change anything for that.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Representative McKay.
Thank you, Chairman. I'd like to ask a question that might clarify the whole discussion. Most folks that drill water wells, fresh water wells for drinking water and let's call it domestic consumption, those wells are usually 50 to maybe 200, 300 feet deep, maybe at the most. For your freshwater aquifers, I don't know how the deepest one is in Alaska, but I think for geothermal energy, I think we're talking about very briny, brackish, salty water that's significantly deeper. So I think maybe we're conflating, you know, freshwater aquifers with geothermal, and it's completely different horizons. Maybe the gentleman on the phone can verify that.
Mr. Barrett?
Yes, this is Tom Barrett. So I'll try to clarify. I think Mr. Masterman presented a slide last week, and he kind of showed the difference in the depth. Like the big geothermal resources, they tend to be on the order of 1,000 to several thousand feet deep.
Okay.
And things like warm springs and hot springs, they tend to be much shallower. And that's correct about aquifers, too. Our freshwater aquifers tend to be shallow and, you know, less than 1,000 feet deep. If that answers your question.
Mr. Masterman, would you like to go over that again, or does that suffice to your point, Mr. Representative McKay?
Well, I think in theory you could have folks that live in a geothermal area who are producing domestic fresh water for their homes and businesses, and
the two are uninterrupted.
The two are completely separated by a long column, you know, of rock. So I think they could coexist without difficulty. I don't think we can conflate the two.
Sorry, I was confused. I thought Mr. Masterman was online, but apparently he isn't. That's fine. Mr. Clifton, looks like you're chomping at the bit there.
Yes, Mr. Chair, we have Dave LePain from DGGS as our subject matter expert. He is on the line, and I believe that he will be happy to confirm the representative's question and expand on it if need be.
Mr. LePain.
Yeah, this is Dave LePain. I'm a geologist with DGGS. I'm here for Steve Masterman. Through the chair, yes, what the DMLW gentleman just said is correct. It's, as Steve said last Friday, it's really a difference in scale. Potable water wells are going to be up in the shallow stratigraphy anywhere from a few tens of feet down to perhaps a few hundreds of feet in the Fairbanks area up in the hills. We have some wells that are upwards of 400 or 500 feet deep, but still they're much shallower than what we're talking about in terms of commercial geothermal energy. Geothermal wells are going to be on the order of many thousands of feet deep. And so, yes, there's going to be a lot of geology, a lot of rock separating those two systems, and there's unlikely to be communication between them. I hope that answers the question and clarifies.
Thank you, Mr. LePain. I believe it does, and we're probably not going to get to this point in the slide just because it looks like it's additional information, but if you go check out page 16, it has a nice little infographic kind of highlighting the difference in depths between the two types of water resource. Thank you for putting that up on the screen. We'll go to the next question, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So I was just about to point out slide 16 to everyone as well. And I think, and I won't speak for other members, but I think some of the concern was it lists, you know, wells ranging from a depth of 200 feet to 10,000 feet. And I think if we were looking at something that was in the realm of 200, 300 feet, I think there may be some concern on the committee that we could see some impact to maybe freshwater wells or otherwise. So one, can you just clarify that we are typically talking about for commercial geothermal power that we are talking about thousands of feet and not potentially 200 as it lists on slide 16? And then my second question is just, you know, when we talk about geothermal reservoirs, I imagine that those can be both deep but also potentially rather broad. And I imagine it's not a infinite source of power or power generation, and I just am curious if there's any concern that one user of geothermal power could dilute that source of energy for another user in the region, but maybe that concern's unwarranted. If you could address that, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah, this is Dave LePain. Through the chair, was that question directed towards DGGS?
I think it was thrown at the board, and whoever can address it, feel free to.
If you could start with that answer, Mr. LePain, I'd appreciate it, and then I can pick up the second question.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for the question. Through the chair, really, they are unlikely. There's unlikely to be communication between the shallow potable water systems and water that a geothermal project would be tapping into. Even if a geothermal project is tapping into relatively shallow water, they're probably going to be on the flanks of a volcano or some sort of geothermal site. And those waters tend to be high in dissolved solids. They tend to be non-potable sources of water. But the statement stands, and it's a correct statement. Most often, geothermal projects are going to be tapping non-potable water sources that are many thousands of feet deep. So the slide that was referred to that showed geothermal wells upwards of on the shallow end, perhaps 200 feet deep, I think that's highly, highly unlikely. I hope that answers the question. Thank you for it.
Thank you, Mr. LePain. I believe there was a second part of the question in regards to consumption between commercial and residential. So if somebody online can answer that.
Yes, Mr. Chair, if I could restate the question a little bit, it seems to me that the question is what would happen if there were a conflict between two users of the same geothermal reservoir? And that would be handled much the same way as it is with other types of energy reservoirs, such as oil and gas. And that is one of the functions of AOGCC is to monitor resource pools and ensure that waste is prevented. And so those things can be deconflicted through existing statutes. But again, it's almost never a problem because the operators who seek to develop those resources also don't want to waste the resources. They want to maximize it as well. So they usually pretty much always manage that on their own through unitization of the resource. And again, you know, we also don't think that there's a likely conflict between a private user of what would be a commercial resource simply because the scale of a commercial grade resource is much bigger and more powerful, you know, higher temperatures and pressures and so forth. It's really unlikely that that's the sort of thing that a private user for their home or cabin is going to be tapping into. But again, if that situation comes up, that is something that AOGCC would be able to deconflict through existing statutes and policies.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. Is that suffice, Representative Shrug?
Yeah, I think that is very enlightening. I appreciate the response. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, through the chair, and I think this is for DGGS. So on that slide 16 where hydrothermal is described, and this is where my triggering of water rights first came from, but so your description of using steam and hot water, should I conclude that the steam and hot water that you're using in a hydrothermal, geothermal energy production is this deep water, briny, water that's already down near the geothermal source and that we're not using surface water for that?
Representative Hannon, thank you for the question through the chair. Yes, that is correct. Hydrothermal systems, you're pumping water from great depths, as we've said, thousands of feet. It's not going to be surface water and very unlikely to be in communication with surface water. So there's a very significant separation in terms of depth, commercial versus, say, private home use. So, yes, you're pumping water from great depths.
Thank you, Mr. LePain. Suffice, Representative Hannon, so far? Thank you. Thank you. Representative Hopkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Clifton, I think you just answered this question, but bringing up AOGCC as the arbitrator for the resource right, do they have statutory authority, as far as you know, to deal with hydrothermic and geothermal resources because of the Alaska oil and gas, not and geothermal?
Yes, they do have statutory authority to adjudicate that stuff and arbitrate conflicts.
All right, thank you.
That G has dual meaning.
I guess so.
No other questions on the introduction of and the continuation of Friday's discussion. I think we could start fresh today with slide number 9, I believe it was. It's 10 now, maybe. So, well, I'll take a brief at ease. Back on the record, Representative Shragi.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. So, yes, we have covered these slides before, and I had just one other question looking at slide 16, which was just, are these pumping water, are these geothermal energy plants pumping water from the reservoir and then re-injecting that same water into that reservoir? Is there any risk that this runs afoul of DEC because we're discharging water back into a reservoir? Is there any concern there? I assume not, but could you just confirm that for me?
This is Dave LaPaine, through the chair. Yes, hot water is pumped from significant depths. It's run through a steam turbine. Electricity is generated. And then the water goes to a cooling tower. It's cooled, and then it's re-injected into the subsurface at a comparable depth. I would assume, I don't have expertise in this area, but I would assume DEC would be involved on the re-injection of that water stream. But perhaps Sean Clifton or somebody else on the call has knowledge in that area. Thank you.
Sean, do you want to try to broach out? Otherwise, we have Laura Ashley on the line with DEC.
Yes, I would like to clarify this, Mr. Chair. So the reinjection part, those wells would also be permitted and regulated through AOGCC, and that's something that they do all the time already with other types of production and injection wells. So that's a fairly standard and usual practice. And then, one of the things to also point out is they pay very close attention to the protection of other water resources, to protect potable or, drinking water sources. And they pay very close attention to that with their engineering regulations. And as far as the surface or potential for surface contamination or discharge or whatever, yes, that would be DEC's domain. And if the representative from DEC would like to speak up and maybe expand on that a little bit, yeah, they're free to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. Ms. Ashay, can you hear us? Can you do a sound check, please, before you begin?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Laura Ashay from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I'm the legislative liaison, and so not familiar with the detailed specifics of permits for discharges to water, but I did share the questions that we got on Friday afternoon with my colleagues who weren't able to be here today. And if the discharges met the parameters that would bring them under DEC's authority, then absolutely they would be required to have permits for discharging that water, and it would have to meet state and federal water quality standards. So that's how DEC would be involved in this process.
Thank you, Ms. Ashay. Representative Shragg.
Yeah, through the chair. So I think what I heard is that if it's being re-injected into the reservoir, DEC does not have oversight. That would be permitted through AOGDC. If it's being discharged on the surface, DEC would be involved and monitor those discharges. But if maybe after today's hearing that could be clarified, that would be appreciated.
Through the chair, Representative Shragi, I will check with our water division staff and get a final answer on that.
Thank you, Ms. Ashay. Mr. Clifton?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I might be able to clarify this now to the representative's satisfaction, if I may. So when facilities like this for an operation would be permitted, I mean, there's extensive review of how the facility is going to be in place to develop the engineering and all of that. And there would, of course, be a contingency plan that they would have to have permitted through DEC, just like any of the other facilities that we have related to oil and gas or power generation and so on and so forth. And that's, it is very important to all of the state agencies who would be connected with that permitting process to protect the surface, protect our drinking water resources, prevent to the greatest extent possible any sort of environmental contamination and have contingencies in place should anything like that occur. So this wouldn't be any different from any of the power generation facilities, oil and gas related sort of facilities that have already been permitted and operating in Alaska for decades.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. Does that satisfy Representative Froggy?
Yes, thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, to the Chair. I just heard you say all those agencies. So I guess the question is, how many agencies are you going to have to answer to actually put one of these in? Do you have any idea?
Through the Chair, I don't know off the top of my head all of the agencies that would be involved. I know, the DNR does do a fair bit of the surface use permitting. We also have some pipeline permitting, which is also a surface area. And then, on top of that, there might be DEC involved, especially for the spill contingency plan stuff. And if there is any planned discharge from the facility, they would have to seek permits for that. Then there might be fish and game involved if there are, is potential for disturbance of wildlife or interference with streams and so on. There might also be federal agencies involved, such as PHMSA. So it can get quite broad, depending on what the potential impacts are. And I haven't personally been involved in the permitting process for the development of a facility, so that's about the extent to how much I can speak on that. But if you need a list of all the potential agencies that might be involved in permitting a surface facility for power generation for geothermal resources, we can get that to you, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Clifton. I think we'll look forward to that extensive list for Wednesday's meeting. I'm sure a majority of those agencies start with A and just a variable of all the other letters of the alphabet, which is important to, discharge, whether it's surface or subsurface. So thank you for that clarification in regards to water rights. Is there anything else committee members would like to ask in regards to the bill, maybe that we can have prepared to be presented on Wednesday when we hope to move the bill out of committee? Representative Hopkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Clifton, maybe you've got the answer for this. I just wanted to go back to the AOGCC jurisdiction. On slide 31, it says jurisdiction over geothermal for AOGCC is triggered by temperature or commerciality. And as we said earlier, this bill is getting rid of the temperature requirement. Is that jurisdiction still covered, even though it's a new definition and we're allowing AOGCC still to have jurisdiction over resource issues, even though we're changing their definition, or how their jurisdiction is triggered?
Yes, through the Chair, if you'll note the last bullet there, the exception, regardless of what the temperature is of the well or so forth, if the well may encounter geothermal resources, fluid, or water of enough heat pressure to threaten life or health, then AOGCC would require permits. And that's regardless of whether or not it's a commercial development or a private landowner. And so that's kind of the fallback or catch-all. If it's determined that the well is going to be a potential hazard, then AOGCC is going to be involved in the permitting process for that.
Follow up?
Representative Hopkins.
Thank you. So if there's 90-degree heat in a shallow well that they have to pump up to the ground, and that's not enough heat or pressure to threaten life or health, and there's all of a sudden a resource discrepancy between two operations as they try to become commercial, AOGCC is not part of that at that point?
Oh, no, through the Chair, a commercial development is going to be permitted through AOGCC.
Despite temperatures, right?
Yes.
Right, just commercial, okay.
Yep. So either of the two prongs can trigger AOGCC involvement if it's not already triggered, with the rest of the process. It's that 120 degree temperature, or it's just simple commerciality. Yep.
That's correct, sir.
Cool.
And by this, okay, even though HB 135 does not deal with temperature anymore, we still have that as a trigger for the jurisdiction of AOGCC?
To the chair, yes.
Interesting. Okay.
Any other questions or comments? Seeing or hearing none. The plan is we've set a amendment deadline for HB 135 1 p.m. tomorrow, and then the plan is to take up those amendments, if there are any, on Wednesday, and then take action as a committee, depending on what the committee's feelings are towards the bill. So we look forward to continued work with the members on the line. And Ms. Boomershine, thank you for joining us in person. And we'll see you all in a couple of days. With that, the meeting is adjourned at 1:39 p.m.